in offering equity to women rights to be ordering as bhikkhunis. And now there is a monastery for bhikkhunis in Australia. How many
bhikkhunis? Well, there's about 11 or 12, and a couple more ordaining in July. So it's growing very strongly. We have that monastery. It's a very beautiful monastery, well established, over in Perth, which is in Western Australia, and another monastery for fully ordained Buddhist women over in Melbourne, the northwest of Melbourne. So it's very, very wonderful to be able to offer the same opportunities as men have to women, so they too can enjoy the seclusion and the peace and the opportunity to serve as monks have. And it's a wonderful thing to do. It was over 10 years ago when I arranged that ordination for four women over in Australia. I got into some trouble for it at the time, but it was only like political trouble. There was nothing wrong with it in any which way. So it's wonderful that now those women are established, they are strong, and one of the disciples just told the government, and so they awarded this medal. Which at first, you don't ever want to receive medals as a monk. What are medals for? But this was for something which was not for me. It was for all the other people who wanted to see gender equity in all parts of our world. And one of those is in religion. And just to let you know, if there are any Catholics in here, there is a very easy way, which is legitimate, to ordain a woman as a Catholic priest. And that is, and sometimes people say it's against canon law, which is the legal document for the Catholic Church. But if you do the ordination on a boat in the middle of the ocean, then there is no legal reason why that ordination does not stand. So if any of you want to be a Catholic priest, fully ordained, just get in a boat in the middle of the Thai Gulf, get someone to ordain you, and not even the Pope can say you're not a fully ordained Buddhist priest. Any takers? No one's ever tried that, but it's nice to be able to know what's possible and what's not possible in this world. What's legal and what's not legal. And that's one of the reasons why. If there's something you can do, then we do it. Shall I just start the talk? So what I was going to do is to talk for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And then the most interesting part of these discussions is always the questions. So when the questions come, I know this is supposed to be Thailand, but as Manuel told me, that the UN building is legitimately, legally, not part of Thailand. It belongs to this UN territory. So here, you can ask any question you wish. So don't be embarrassed at all. And more than that, I like questions because it's questions. Questions are what reveals the truth. And tough questions usually reveal deep truths. So please feel free to ask any question, especially at the end of this 45-minute session. But there is, first of all, the talk was chosen by somebody else, and I like it to be chosen by someone else rather than myself, simply because, you know, I would always talk about the things I feel comfortable with. So talking about things like equality and fairness, and just some of the terrible things which happened to our planet Earth, it's challenging. But first of all, the whole idea of equality, I like to put it in a much wider perspective. This, that wider perspective on equality is, I can't see why on the opening lines of the US Constitution it was written that it's a self-evident fact that all men are created equal. Number one, it's not self-evident. Number two, it misses out. Only one gender is mentioned there, and it's, to me, it's evident in what I see, that people are not born equal. But the point is not equality, but what we call equities. In other words, even though that people will be born with different faculties, different opportunities, different whatever, the idea of being able to rise above your upbringing and to make use of it in such a way to live a very fulfilling life, that is called like equity. To take barriers away from people when those barriers are just not necessary, they're not reasonable, they're not logical. Take those barriers so people from whatever race, religion, agenda or race, if a person can do the job, they should be given the chance to do that job. If they want to follow that path, give them that opportunity to follow that path. And to have this idea that you are brought into this world, and don't look for what's missing in your life. Look for what you can do, where you can reach, how far you can go. And a little example of that is, this is my 69th year. I was born in 1951. My family were very poor by UK standards. And nevertheless, I managed to work hard and get a scholarship to Cambridge University. And at those universities, you hung around with some so-called very intelligent people. So-called. But then I remember I was a Buddhist even then at Cambridge. And one of my friends, who was a devout Christian, said that he was volunteering to do some social work at Fulbourne Hospital, which was a hospital for people with, they called disabilities, emotional problems. And they were going to volunteer, and I thought, just out of pride, if the Christians can do it, the Buddhists can do it as well. So I decided to wave the flag of Buddhism and go along as well. And I went there for 2 years without hardly missing one afternoon. And I enjoyed it. I learned so much from that time working with mostly Down syndrome people. They were supposed to have a disability. But then on reflection, they weren't disabled as much as the professors and lecturers were. An example of that, I told this last night, that one day, one afternoon, I was going to this class in occupational therapy, whatever, and with my friends who all Down syndrome, people, beautiful people. And one of them came running towards me. They saw me coming from a distance. And for the first time, they flung their arms around me and gave me this enormous hug. They'd never done that before. And I was stunned and shocked. Why are you hugging me? And they said, there's something wrong, isn't there? There's something wrong with you. What's wrong? And I couldn't believe it, that somehow or other, that Down syndrome person, friend, had noticed in my facial demeanor or my way I walked or whatever that I was really upset. The night before I broke off with my girlfriend. This was a long time before I was a monk, okay? To make it clear. But nevertheless, he picked it up straight away. And he gave me this very welcome hug. So you're okay, it doesn't matter. And that he could notice that stunned me, still stuns me. Over maybe 50 years later. How could he know that? There was an emotional intelligence amongst these people which I respected and I learned from for those 2 years I could go and visit them. And so to this day, are they somehow lesser? They need to be made equal? They somehow need to be cured of their disabilities? And these days I say, no way. Because their disabilities, and I'm not just saying this to make them feel good, is their beauty, is their strength. And to understand what I mean, there's a simile which I probably gave here last year. It's one of my favorite similes, which I gave once that clients of mental health, these weren't the professors or the nurses, the doctors, the psychologists. These were the people who were their clients. And they came there not knowing why a monk was talking to them. But I told them that being a forest monk, because I spent all my years when I'm not in Bangkok and other cities in forests, I always noticed the most beautiful trees. And before I tell you what the most beautiful trees are, I maybe ask you the next time you have a day or two off, and you go into a park or a forest or a mountain, go and look for a perfect tree. What is a perfect tree? You try and find one which is dead straight, which is not leaning to the left or the right. Find one with all the branches in the correct place, but no branches having been torn off by the winds or the storm. Find one with all the leaves beautifully green, no yellow, no brown leaves, no leaves being eaten by bugs. Try and find a tree with no damage on the bark. Such a tree does not exist. You can look for one. I go to Singapore, even in Singapore where they like perfection, there's no perfect trees there either. But if you did find one, it would not be beautiful. In fact, the really beautiful trees, the ones you would like to have your photograph taken by, the one you would like to visit again and again and again, the favorite ones are all bent and twisted. They've got branches broken off by the storms of nature. They have holes where those branches used to be, and that's where birds make their nest, or in Australia, the little possums. They have brown leaves and leaves which have been eaten by the bugs, which makes them incredibly beautiful patterns. And on their trunk, they've got some scars there. Scars and holes and bumps, and which makes them gorgeous. The most beautiful trees in all the forests where I've lived are usually the ones which are damaged. So I told these clients, if you, if someone has told you, you're damaged goods, number one, you belong. You belong in the beautiful forest of humanity. And number two, if you're really damaged, you are some of the most beautiful trees that we have in the forest. So never one, think you're rejected. Number two, never think because what you have been through, the inequality, the harm, the violence, the abuse, whatever it is, never think that that makes you rejected, not beautiful, not an amazing human being. You are welcome. You belong. And number two, those with these really incredible stories are some of the most beautiful people you can ever wish to meet when you listen to their stories. It's amazing how they've survived. Why they survive, and what they've got from this. So it's looking at tragedy, at hurt and harm, in a totally different way. Like maybe personal story, because I said I came from a poor family. My father just hitchhiked down from Liverpool just after the Second World War, penniless, getting any job he could. And of course, he eventually met my mother, and then I came along with my brother. But I always would ask my father about my paternal grandfather. And my paternal grandfather was never ever mentioned by my own dad. He was a mystery to me. Every time I asked him, what did my paternal grandfather did. My father would never tell me. Until it got to a time when I was 15 or 16, I impressed my father so much, he told me. And please excuse the language here, because this is what my father said. He said, "Your grandfather was a bastard." My father never used that language before. And that shocked me. So what are you talking about? And then he explained his experience growing up in a very poor home during the Depression years in Liverpool before the Second World War. He said his father was a plumber. Whatever work he got, he would spend the money in the pub drinking. He would come home almost every night drunk, and he would take off his belt, and he would beat any kid, including my father, who happened to be in the way. My father said he could take those beatings, it doesn't matter how much they hurt, for no reason whatsoever. But he said what he could never take, what hurt him more than the slap of leather on his own flesh, was to see his father, my paternal grandfather, then start to beat his wife. And my father loved his mother, but could not protect her. He said that hurt so much. And he said that when he was seeing his mother being hurt, when he was receiving the beating himself, he said he made a promise to himself. His promise was, if he survives, if he manages to live through this, and if ever he gets married and has kids, he would never, ever hit them. And of course, he did survive. And I was one of those kids. And even though I may have deserved it many times, he could not hit us. He tried and then said, "No, I can't do this." So he brought back those memories. It was a case of someone who had abuse, who was born in a very difficult situation, but decided never to revisit that abuse on anybody else. He never could. He was a very soft and kind, forgiving man. That is how, one way, where those of us who have witnessed, or even worse, experience hard abuse, physical, emotional, sexual, how we can, instead of revisiting it on somebody else, learn to understand how much it hurts. So you never, ever want to do that to anybody else. And you can't. It's a way of using the difficulties and the pain of life, really learning it, and then never doing that to anybody else. And I'm sure that many of you who work for the United Nations come here. You've probably seen terrible things happen in this world, maybe experience them yourself. I never want to do that to anybody else. I never want to give people the opportunity to do that to anybody else. To try and find ways and means so that we can behave more like human beings than wild animals. So, we want to try and find ways of not just stopping abuse and harm, but giving people hope. Hope that there is a path to a better life, even in some of the most difficult times of your life. There was one of the stories which my father told me, the Dharma story. He wasn't a Buddhist, he couldn't even spell the word. But he told me when I was about 13 or 14, he took me aside and he said to me, "Son, however you turn out in your life, whatever you become," I was about 13 or 14 at the time, "whatever you become in your life, I want you to remember this. The door of my house will always be open to you." I was only 13 or 14. I did not understand what he meant. Because his house was what they call a small council flat. Cheapest possible accommodation which people could get at that time.
And it wasn't much of a house. I often used to say to people that we wouldn't really worry about locking the door of our house in those days, in the 50s. In fact, I asked my father, well, why don't we lock the door? He said, no. But a burglar might come in. Exactly, he said. And if a burglar comes in, he may take pity on us and leave us something. That's why we kept the door open. But anyway, when he had told me that the door of his house was open, only when I became a monk. One of the advantages of being a monk is you have time. You don't get much money, in fact no money, one meal a day, very sort of strict training. But you do have time to meditate and to understand your emotional world, which was very rare, I must admit, for a boy. And so I remember what my father was saying. The wood didn't mean the door of his house, he meant the door of his heart. When that understanding hit me, he meant his heart was always open for me. He would never reject me. He would never lock the door and say, no, you're not my son, can't come in. It was an expression of what we call unconditional love. I'll love you no matter what. You can embarrass me, you can rob me, you could say terrible things about me. I don't care, you're my son, that's enough. I'll always love you. And that meant so much to me. It meant so much to me that I started teaching that to others. How if you really, really want to love somebody, your partner in this life, to find that time to actually to say to them, the door of my heart will always be open to you, no matter what you ever do, my partner in this life. That takes a lot of trust. It makes you very vulnerable. People are afraid of being taken advantage of. Try it. See what happens. That's the right person. There's no way I could ever take advantage of my father when he said something like that. I had to live up to his trust and his love. That's what love is about, trust. So anyhow, teaching that for such a long time, that then there is a group over in Perth where I live. And for those of you who want to know why I ended up in Western Australia, and this is pretty accurate. It may sound funny to you, but it's accurate. When I first became a monk, you made all sorts of resolutions, promises to yourself. And one of those promises was that I would never ask to go anywhere. Once I became a disciple of Ajahn Chah, then I would wait for Ajahn Chah to send me somewhere, and when he wanted me back, I'd wait for him to ask me to come back. And that was, what was it, 1983, he sent me to Australia, and about 2 weeks after he sent me to Australia, Ajahn Chah had a stroke, and he couldn't speak after that, which is why I ended up in Australia. He couldn't ask me to come back. But anyhow, I didn't mind. But over there, giving lots and lots of talks, I received an invitation one day to give a talk at a group which I'd never been to before. It was called the Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. Did I tell this story last year? Okay, good. I'm getting old now, my memory for what I did from last year. I've given so many talks since. But the Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma was a group which dealt with people, refugees, asylum seekers, who had actually managed to find physical freedom in a country like Australia, but were still carrying the trauma of their times, being tortured, beaten, raped, in underground places whose location they did not know. They kept on physically living in Australia, But a lot of the times their emotions were stuck in these far off lands, a year, 2 years, 5 years ago. And this society was helping them. And how they were helping them, why do you want me to go here? They said, because many of the things the director told me, which really work, we learned from you, Ajahn Brahm. And that was just really quite a compliment. What exactly? He said, especially this opening the door of your heart. Because the practice, the little therapy, which was creating so much positive results, was having some of these refugees, when they felt safe, safety was paramount, when they felt confident enough to do this, was to close their eyes and imagine their heart in the middle of their chest, like a Valentine's Day heart, something simple, but with two big doors, just like, you know, half the doors you came in there, a double door in the middle, and opening that door of your heart, just imagining this. And you, that part of you which you can cope with, which you respect, which you like, is inside your heart. The one you find it easy to live with. Then you look outside, on the ground, on the concrete, in the cold, in the wet. There are those little youths, many years ago, who were beaten so badly, who were raped again and again for no cause, who have been so tortured and beaten and hurt. They're out there. And you imagine that that's you, that's part of you. And you imagine a staircase coming down from your heart to that concrete floor. And then you invite all these rejected parts of you, the ones you're so scared about. But that's part of you, that's who you are. Terrified part of you, invite them up. Come in. The door of my heart is open to you as well. And I was surprised, shocked. I never recommended to take that simile that far. But they took it that far. And it works. One by one, all those parts of you in your history, in your memory, the parts of you which you're ashamed of, you feel dirty about, whatever, invite them up. Come in. You're welcome. When they come to the top of the stairs, embrace. Thank you. I will never shut you out of my heart ever again. And what happens, because the anecdote which I recall was in my temple over in Perth, one of these women, she didn't say where she was from, but she was telling a young man of what she'd been through, which was gross to the max. But the man was just stunned. Number one, that what she had endured and survived. But number two, that she could talk so freely about it. And he made a big mistake by saying, "That's terrible what happened to you." And this was the beautiful part. She looked at him and said, "What are you talking about? That was terrible what happened to me. That's who I am. That's Mamie. That was tough as anything. But that's me." She had embraced the terror of her past. And so she was like a saint. She was one of these people who, whoa, beautiful person to be around now, totally at ease with herself and so much to offer to other people in the world. This is not equality. It's equity for some people who have been really, really so badly treated. And it can work. It can happen. That's one example of many. Obviously, is it so obvious? We should not have that torture anyway. This is our human realm. We try and lessen it. Last night I was giving a talk to say, this is our human world. As far as the Buddhist is concerned, this will never be perfect. It doesn't mean we can't try and improve it to make it better. It's not supposed to be a perfect world. No more than a school is perfect. Where all the children in the school know everything about everything. No, this is where we learn. And I gave the simile of the 70% rule. The 70% rule goes like this. When I was a school teacher for 1 year before I became a monk. As I often quip, if you teach high school children for 1 year, you'll make anyone think about leaving the world and becoming a monk. It's really hard work. But anyway, that when I had to set my first examination in maths, I never set an exam before, so I didn't know what to do. So I went up to a senior math teacher and asked for advice. And he gave this very beautiful advice of not making the exam too hard. If you make the exam too hard, so people only score 20%, 30%, even the ones who can do maths will think they can't. They will lose their inspiration, their motivation, their confidence because they get a low score. If you set the exam too easy, so everyone gets 100%, 95%, it will be a pointless exam. So he said, aim for 70%, 70%. 70% is a good score. It means you feel confident, yeah, I can do maths. But even more than the 70% of your success, the most important part was the 30% where you make mistakes. That was important for me, their teacher, to learn what my students hadn't properly understood. Which I assumed, I thought they'd understood it, but they hadn't. Here's my feedback. So the next few lessons, I can focus on where those students made mistakes. It was not about judging people, just about the teacher getting feedback and encouraging the students. So the learning could continue. And after I did that, an exam in maths, after that I realized how useful that was in life. If you always score 100% in life, you may have an easy life, but you don't learn anything. You're not growing. You're not challenging yourself and increasing your abilities to understand your body, your mind, your heart, and other people in this world. Life has to be challenging, but not too challenging. Because if you only get 20%, 30% in life, people think they're failures, they get depressed, they get even suicidal sometimes. They think they're awful, they're terrible. But if you can try and make it about 70%, you're learning, you're growing, you feel you're okay. And the 30% where you fail, that is not failure. That is the growing opportunities. So I never will ever expect this world to be perfect. 100%. Otherwise there'd be no point living in this world. Instead, 70% is just about right. Where there's mistakes, where there's things to be done, especially for people who are committed to working in the United Nations, that's where you have to work. But when we do work, equity, fairness, just like with those Down syndrome kids, is it really fair? What are you talking about? I only know my life. Do you really understand other people's lives? How can you judge my life is better than yours, or your life is better than mine? We can't even know that, the idea of faith, not fear. Why can't I be the boss? Why can't I be the head of the United Nations place in Bangkok? Then I could really do things properly. If you were the boss of this organization, what would you do? Could you really do it anyway? One of the nice things about being a monk, a senior monk, you get to know all these really interesting people. Prime ministers and presidents and kings and stuff. Now to get to know them. And there was one president some time ago. I better be careful not to say his name. But he was of a South Asian country. And this president told me, first time I met him, he came to see me, just himself, no recordings. He said, I'm a failure. He was one of the most popular presidents in that country at that time. And he admitted he was a failure. That totally took me by surprise. And he said that he became, and I got no reason to doubt him, talking to a monk. He was a Buddhist. And he said that, probably get to know who he is now, giving the game away, but I won't say his name. But anyway, he said that he became a politician and eventually a president, executive president, to try and solve the problems in this country peacefully. He said he couldn't do it. So he chose a violent option. He said, I'm a failure. And the pain, which he let me see, was actually quite rare. Because if anyone else would have put that in the newspaper straight away. But to actually understand how these leaders think and feel inside. What you see on the news, what you see probably in the TV reports, it's just the face they put on, the act they put on. If you ever meet many of these and really get to know them and let them open up to you, a lot of them feel failures. Don't be too hard on them. So anyhow, when you see such people, it's just so easy to say, they should be doing this, they should be doing that. Another way is actually being kind to them. It's counterintuitive. Not agreeing with our leaders, but being kind is a totally different thing. And to understand this, it's an old story from a long time ago. There was this gentleman who almost grew up in our temple over in Western Australia, and eventually became a doctor over in his hospital in a registrar. But anyway, he came to see me one morning about lunchtime, and he said, I can't do this job any longer. I'm going to have to resign. And that's all the years of study and hard work, getting into medical school, and just all that work, qualifying, becoming a doctor, and now he wanted to resign. Why? And then he told me what happened that very morning. It was very painful for him to tell me that one of his patients, he was supposed to be looking after, 23-year-old woman, died unexpectedly. And of course he thought it was his fault. Now later on it was proved it was no one's fault. It was one of these conditions which most doctors would have missed. He missed it. She died. But then what happened next was the doctor had to tell this woman's husband, who was not prepared for her dying, never expected it, to say that the woman he'd committed his life to was no longer alive. And then his two young children had no mother. You can imagine what that would do to you if you got that news. What that did to this man, and even the doctor who had to give that news, he felt just a knife going into his chest and twisting two times for each kid. It was a terrible thing to have to say. It was so painful that he vowed he'd have to resign. He could never do that again. At which point, I comes along and I tell him, you've totally misunderstood the point, the main priority of being a doctor. Being a doctor, your main job is not to cure people. If you think curing is your main priority, you will fail many times. People die. You get it wrong. Sometimes things happen which you've never seen before. People will die. You will fail if you think curing is your main object. But if you understand that being a doctor, your main purpose is to care, not to cure. Make caring the reason why you go to hospital to be a doctor. And then you will find two things. You will never, ever feel a failure. You can always care, always, any place, any time, any situation. You can always care, but you cannot always cure. And number two, I said, not only will you feel a success, but you'll probably find out, and he laughed afterwards, you'll probably find out you'll cure more people when you make caring the most important thing. Do you understand that? You care for people rather than trying to cure them. And then curing happens almost like a byproduct of caring. When he understood that, he went back to work. And he's a very specialist doctor now. Does he cure many people? He cares for everybody. And he's a specialist, very successful, because he does cure a lot more people than you would expect. Caring is more important than curing. So you can start experimenting with that to see if it works with the person you live with, your partner in life. Would you like to cure him of all his bad habits? Cure her of all of her bad habits? Would you like to do that? Forget it. Care for him, care for her. And if you care for them, then you find the curing happens. Do you want to cure all the bad things going on in this organization? Just the UN. Do you want to cure it all? Yeah, you do, don't you? Mind about caring for it instead. And then the cure happens. Okay, what about the environment? Ecological disaster. Do you want to cure it all or care? Which do you want to do? The caring comes first. So whenever we have any protest movements, any mass mobilization of human beings, which are pointing to a problem, for goodness sake, just care for the people who you're protesting against. Because if you have any thoughts of violence or rage, then the protesters become worse than the people or the situation you're protesting against. They became part of the problem. I still remember growing up in London, which was the center of two big world wars. And I used to talk about the First World War, which totally devastated Europe, took away so many young men and young women in all these beautiful countries, countries which were friends before. And they said, it was a war to end all wars. And they thought the devastation, the amount of people killed, would never be repeated because it was so terrible. What happened afterwards? Second World War. Third World War, as some commentators say, is that still happening in different ways, in different places in our world? Have we really stopped fighting? Starts off with the protests. And eventually it gets violent. I've been there, seen that in my life, and there's something, you get the mass hysteria. And it is hysterical sometimes to see the way that people would never treat one another individually with such anger or violence. But in a group, you can. And both sides are human beings, with people who love them and care for them. Sure, there must be another way. So protest, fine. But for goodness sake, make sure it's non-violent. One of my heroes, as you probably understand, was people like Gandhi. And it was Mahatma Gandhi who once said, "I can see 1,000 reasons to give my life for a cause. I can't see one reason to take the life of another human being." That was inspiring. He could protest, but always non-violently. And the very fact that this non-violent, thin guy dressed in white, he could remove the most powerful empire from his homeland, my ancestors, the British Raj, to move that from India with non-violence was incredible. He did that. What a wonderful way of protest that was. Many people took beatings. Many people were put in jail. Many people died. But he would never hate the enemy. Mandela, when he was released, became president of South Africa, had all the opportunity to take revenge. What did he do? Forgave. No revenge. This is a wonderful way of solving the problems of our world with kindness. I'm a Buddhist monk, maybe I'm biased, I don't know. But that's what I have seen, what I think works in this world. Violent protest. There's many things need to be changed in this world. We will always change them. And when I'm dead and each one of you are dead, there'll be more things to change. The 70% rule. We will always be making a better world. We'll never make a perfect world. Because if we made a perfect world, there'd be no causes for our children to fight for. They'd be losing out on this wonderful method of being a human being, caring, helping, sacrificing for the betterment of others. I promised 45, 50 minutes. I have completed those 50 minutes. Now we ask for some questions. The harder the questions, the better. Thank you. Okay, questions or complaints? I know I'm a monk, you don't have to say sadhu, sadhu, well done, and go outside the door and say, "That was a terrible talk." So please, questions, comments. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed that. Got me thinking about forgiveness, because holding grudges is something that I've sort of struggled with and trying to get better at, but still, you know, I have to admit our flaws here. So what advice can you give to someone who's maybe been hurt by people in the past, but want to embrace them and dealing with that whole issue of forgiveness? Thank you.
Dealing with the issue of forgiveness, you can't go past, because I've mentioned it already, Mandela's and Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission after the South African apartheid regime. And one of the articles, inspiring articles, was of a white South African police officer, secret police officer, who was confessing to how he tortured and killed a black African ANC activist. The terrible, terrible things happened. The police at that time were literally above the law, do whatever they wanted almost. But anyway, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was offering amnesty, amnesty as long as you told the truth. Confess exactly what happened. The truth would be rewarded with amnesty, because I wanted to find out what was going on, why it was going on, what happened to people. And so this man, apparently reading the transcript, was shaking, crying, emotionally traumatized by confessing in a court how he'd tortured and killed this man, black African ANC activist, in front of the man's widow. This woman, she'd married this fellow, had his children. He disappeared in the middle of the night. She never knew what had happened to him. She suspected, like many other black African activists who have disappeared, what had happened to him, but this was the first time she'd heard in detail the story. Imagine just how traumatic that would be. The person you loved in your life, the father of your children, how he was, just because he was fighting for a just cause, was tortured and killed. And then, at the end of his testimony, this young black widow jumped over the barriers, avoided the security. She managed to get to this guy, the murderer of her husband, the father of her kids. And she gave him this huge hug, saying, "I forgive you. I forgive you." And everyone in the courtroom just burst out crying. To forgive a person who'd tortured and killed this extrajudicially, the man you loved. That was just amazing. If you can forgive that much, why can't we forgive people who just hurt us? You're still alive. You haven't been just thrown out of a window to your death. So, that was an extreme which really moved me to, there's nothing which you can't forgive. But forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting and just ignoring it. Once you have forgiveness, there's an opportunity of having truth. Why can't we ever find out what really happened? Why do people lie? Because that's one of our everyone's precepts, we're not supposed to lie. But how many people lie? Of course you lie. Why is that? And this little story makes it quite clear. There was a court case going on in New York many years ago when there was still the death penalty. And there was this person who was on charge with murder. And if he was found guilty, he would go to, at that time, the electric chair. And so during the testimony he was giving, the judge stopped him and said, "Look, you're saying one thing now. You said something some time ago which was different. Sir," he said, "do you not know that the penalties for perjury in New York are very severe?" And the defendant said, "Yes, I know perjuries are very severely punished in this state, but it's not punished as much as murder." In other words, lying was in his interest. He would get a lesser penalty. And to so many people in our world, if you don't tell the truth, the penalty is less. Which is one of the reasons why telling truth, being honest, should always be forgiven, no matter what you did. And one of the ways I can influence this world is only to a small amount of people. Whenever they get married, they want a Buddhist blessing. And that's one of the things I tell them. I said, you know, husband and wife, or two husbands, two wives, like partners in same-sex marriage, if you're together, then can't you not make a vow the two of you, to say, partner, if you tell me the truth, I will never get upset or angry at you. Please, there's one person in this world, your partner in life, who you can always trust will tell you the truth. And if you can do that, then you can find out that, yeah, there's difficulties and problems in life, but at least you know, as a couple, what's the truth, what's not the truth. How difficult is it when you find out your partner's been lying to you? Even more than that, your children. Those of you who have kids, have you ever told your kids, son, daughter, whatever happens to you, please tell us the truth. If you tell us the truth, we will never ever shout at you, take away privileges, punish you at all. That started off when a woman, young lady, 17, 18, came up to me, 16 I think. She said, Ajahn Brahm, I need your help. I said, why? What's happened? She was still at school, high school. She said, I'm pregnant. I said, have you told your mum and dad? And she said, no, that's your job. I said, why me? Why can't you tell your mum and dad? She said, because they'll kill me. You know, and of course, that really shook me. Why is it when it's something so important to, you know, your daughters, your son, that they're pregnant or the son's got involved with drugs, the time they need their parents most, they're most afraid of telling you. They're afraid of punishment. My father will kill me if he found out. So of course I went to their parents and just told them, there's a daughter, they make mistakes, I don't know who the boyfriend is, but give her a break, she needs your assistance, not your punishment. Why is it that so many of your kids sometimes get into trouble? They don't come and tell you. They're afraid of you. Forgiveness is the antidote to being afraid. You can go and tell your parents what happened. You're not afraid to. You're embarrassed to, but you're not afraid. Because it's not going to be punishment, it's going to be forgiveness. Understanding, learning the problems, and going forward. That's why we forgive. To find the truth. And once we have the truth, we know where the problems are, and we can solve them. How often in the UN, what happened? What really happened? And you just can't find out. No more will tell you the truth because they're afraid of punishment. So isn't it beautiful if people can practice that trust with one another? So we never feel like we need to be punished. Therefore we can be honest and find out the truth and get a much, much better outcome. And anyway, look, a lot of people are religious in this world. If they've done something wrong, God will punish them. If you're a Buddhist or a Hindu, karma will get you. So, there's no escape. So, you know, you will have to, you know, do some penance for whatever you've done wrong in this life. But you don't need to be the person who gives that penance. You can forgive them. What a beautiful person that is who forgives others. Don't say, accept what you've done. I want to find out more what you've done. And why you did that? What did you do that for? There's many other ways of dealing with each other. So that's forgiveness is paramount to the discovery of truth. There's almost another talk I gave there, sorry. Okay, next question. Yeah, thank you.
Hi. Thank you very much for your talk, although I missed the first 10 minutes of your talk, but I feel warmer, empowered, and softer at my heart. It's not a question, but I'd like to request you to elaborate more on anger, because I've been working on issues on disability rights, and I've been seeing lots of advocates around the world who's been advocating on issues. And sometimes I feel, I see, not sometimes, often, I see the power of anger. Because anger makes people to elaborate on issues and act on it and then take actions and articulate their messages and then leading to policy change and better implementation. But I also see sometimes people who are driven by anger is a little bit too, you can't really approach to them. So I see both sides, but I don't have any judgment about anything, but I just felt that you might, I would like to ask you your take on that. Thank you.
Well, first of all, just because you're a monk, you're not sort of a god who always speaks the right things. I talk from the position of being a monk. And of course, you know, my lifestyle is just to let go of all anger, so anger just doesn't exist in one anymore. And to the point that, you know, that's how I see the world. Others may see it differently. But the point of the United Nations is seeing so many different parts of our world and using the best from each. So, as a human being, I teach from my perspective, and you'll get other people up here teaching from another perspective. There's never ever going to be one right, one wrong, or we put everything together. But to me, I've seen too many bad results of anger. And you don't hear the message anymore. You just see the anger. And if you do anything, you do it out of fear of the anger of that other person. You don't know why you're doing it. For such a long time when I was at school, I could see the anger of the teachers if you made a mistake. I never knew why. They wouldn't tell you. So that's the wrong thing to do. Why? So it's one of the things which I saw that, please explain why. You get things like speed cameras or not driving a car when you've had alcohol. Why? And I still remember that time when I did a funeral service, one of the most saddest funeral services I've ever done in Australia. It was a young girl, she was maybe 21, 22. She'd been sent by her parents in mainland China. Only one child they had at the time, one child policy in China at the time. And she graduated, and she invited her parents over for a graduation ceremony. And she was walking down the street with her parents. Parents couldn't understand any English. They were just poor people who sacrificed everything, their whole life for their daughter. And then two people drunk in the car, lost control of the car, slammed into her and killed her. And I did a funeral service for her. And it was just one of the saddest ones I'd seen. Now I understood why drink driving is dangerous. Why it should be banned. Punishing people for it. Some people can afford the fine. Some people can argue, well. But that's not the point. Seeing why. So instead of getting angry and feeling punished and feeling afraid, why? There's a far better way of dealing with the problems of our world. I don't know if that answers the question or not, but I think anger can solve a problem temporarily, but doesn't really get deep into why. And the one who can shout the loudest, who has the most friends, has the biggest army, to express their anger, they're the ones who usually win temporarily, create so much problem in our world. I think human beings are much better than that. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but that's how I live. Yes, thank you.
Well, life is unfair. We do wrong things and we may not get punished, we may do great things and we may not be rewarded. But why is that the relationship with religion always has these bases? You do something good, you get credit on karma, you go to hell, heaven. You do something bad, you get punished, God is going to punish you, go to hell, you get bad points on karma. Why is that, considering life is so may be far from this reality, but religion would be.
Yeah, okay.
Just based on this point.
It's, first of all, when I saw the title of this talk, which I said I did not choose, but I'm very happy to talk about it, I just remembered one of my teachers at school in a philosophy class was asking, why should things be fair? Why? It was a very great start of a train of thought. Why should things be fair? And if there's no fairness there, no justice, no equity, then something which is doesn't give us a framework for living. It creates more and more problems if we accept there's no fairness, that if we're smart enough we can get away with things. You also have, and having worked with many prisoners in jail, because that's one of the things I did when I first went over to Western Australia, go to jails and talk to these prisoners and learn from them. One of the things I learned, I never yet met a prisoner who doesn't feel bad about what they've done. I know there's some things which psychologists call psychopaths. I haven't seen one. I think the psychologists haven't gone deeper into that human being to gain their trust, to understand what's really going on inside of them. Most of the people I've seen, and these have been multiple murderers, these are people who feel terrible about what they've done. So there is that inside of us, the sense that of fairness, of equity, of wanting everyone to have an even playing field as much as we can get it. So that means that it's true that sometimes you get away with things. I always remember this one prisoner who came up to me once. He was this old prisoner. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, I never did the robbery for which I was put in jail for. I didn't do that. I know other prisoners will say the same to you, that they didn't do it. But I did not do that robbery. And the way he said it, and his honesty, you know, made me start thinking. I know the prisoners in jail don't have much opportunity. And they don't have access to telephones. I did. So I thought, who can I call to right a wrong? Someone put in jail for something they didn't do. And that's what I was thinking, who I'd call as soon as I got outside the jail. He smiled this really wicked smile at me and said, but, Ajahn Brahm, there are so many other robberies where I got away with it. I suppose this is fair. You got put in jail for a crime you didn't do. You got away with so many other crimes. You thought, oh, that is fair. How many times do you not get caught speeding? Do you not get caught drink driving? Do you not get caught doing something wrong? How many times do you complain it's not fair? I didn't get caught today. Sometimes, maybe, if we did an account, maybe it does get balanced after a while. It's a nice way of looking at it. It's a very Thai way of doing it. In Thailand, many, many lives. So they say, well, I don't know why this happened to me this life. Maybe it's because I did something wrong in my previous life. You know what happens then? A lot of the psychological damage is stopped straight away. It answers this terrible question which we have, psychological. When something goes wrong in your life, why? Why? If you can't find some answer there which satisfies the human need for fairness, the society demand for equity, if you can't find that, you almost drive you crazy. But if you can find some reason, even like, well, maybe in my past life I got away with things and now I get caught. So, okay, it's fair. Sometimes that is something which I have seen, is a very helpful societal attitude. It helps. So maybe the religious answers to difficulties is it works. That's why they happen. So maybe. If life wasn't fair, what would you do? Yes.
On a slightly different note, I wanted to ask you how one should cope with generational trauma, because being from a South Asian country which was colonized for 200 years, and even though I haven't faced it myself, a lot of people back home, we carry this sense of feeling less, whether it's based on color or our ethnicity, we always feel less than people from somebody else or somebody who's fairer, or
yeah.
How do you think we should cope with that? Because it's not something we necessarily went through, but...
Yeah, exactly. Even I was quite surprised when I gave talks over in Germany. Even these are grandchildren of people who were in the Second World War, still feel a lot of guilt, a lot of trauma. And I was really surprised at that. It's not just the people who were alive in Germany at the time who participated in a war, and part of that war was the killing of so many Jewish people, disabled people, gay, lesbian, transgender people. And there were so many terrible things happened there, but that was their grandparents, and I don't know, maybe they didn't have much choice. But then that went to their parents, and now to them. Why does that keep going down the line from generation to generation to generation? And I think that's because of the stories of our culture. And I think as a South Asian who is now in Thailand, I don't know if you're married yet, you may have an English husband or something, I don't know what you've got. But one nice thing is that now we always do mix up our cultures. And I think that trying to preserve one culture about another culture is just trying to insist you always go to South Asian restaurants. You don't try a nice Thai restaurant or a Chinese or something else. And so that's one of the reasons why I think that problem will overcome as our cultures mix, as we meet one another, live in each other's countries, have friends of all different nations. A nice positive story about the old man and the violin. Once in a country a long way away, this old man, he worked so hard up in the mountains and fields, making enough money so his children could get good education. And they were very smart, so they graduated from high school, went to universities, got good jobs as doctors, lawyers, working in the UN and places like that. And then they said, well, let's invite our father down to see the city for the first time. So invited, it's the first time he'd ever seen a city. But his inquisitiveness was so strong that when he heard this terrible sound, the worst sound he'd ever heard in his whole life, he followed it to its source, and there he saw a young boy trying to play a violin. And being a simple man from the village up in the mountains, he didn't realize that it was just the boy was trying to learn how to play it. He thought it was a violin's fault. And he said, I never want to hear a violin ever again. It's the most terrible instrument. I don't know why you want to play such a bad-sounding instrument. And a few hours later, he passed another part of the city where the most heavenly sound was coming out from the room. He had to find out what it was. And there, in the front room of another house, he saw an old lady playing the same instrument, the violin, and he realized his mistake. It's not that the violin's fault. It was just that young boy had not yet learned how to play it properly. That's all. And he realized it's just the same with the different cultures, the different religions, the different philosophies of our world. Maybe it's because we see someone who hasn't learned how to play that philosophy or that religion properly yet. But the best part of this story is, a few hours later in the evening, he heard the most amazing sound he'd ever heard in his whole life. It made him shiver with excitement and tears came from his eyes. He said it was more beautiful than the sound of the early morning bird chorus in the mountains. It's more exciting than the little streams bubbling after a heavy rainstorm. And sometimes more peaceful than the wind through the mountain crags. It's the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his life. And what was it? An orchestra. And he said, and everyone in that orchestra was a maestro of their own instrument. And having mastered their own philosophy, religion, culture, then they'd taken it to the next level. They learned to play together in harmony. What beautiful music that was. So what a wonderful thing it is, United Nations, an orchestra of people from so many different lands and cultures and religions and philosophies and faith, learning how to play together in harmony. Far greater than an instrument, so an instrumentalist, playing one instrument is when we play different instruments all together. Most beautiful sound, an orchestra. That's my answer to you. Does that make sense? You don't have to nod. You can say, no, that's not my question. Very good, thank you. Yes.
Ajahn Pham, Honorable Ajahn Pham, Pasva speaking. May I ask my question? I don't see you much express on the law of karma. But I heard that when you talk about the law of karma, how do you find it different try to explain it to the foreigners? Because for the Thai people or for the Asians, we have strong belief when we can find any reason why do we have to what do you say to restrain or to confront with problems if we cannot find any logistic way to say that maybe we have done we did it in previous life as you said.
Yeah.
But how do you explain this law of karma to the Westerner, especially the Australians or the English people, not the Asian people, because I think maybe they don't have strong belief and not easy to believe or to conform with the law of karma as much as the Asian people. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, most people in Asian countries that look at karma as just an explanation of what has happened, happening right now. What did I do? What did the world do to have to experience this? But of course, the other part of karma is, what are you doing now to make a beautiful future? It seems to be that we're looking too far into the past instead of looking into the future. The past is finished. We can't go back into a time machine and change it. We can learn from it. The most important thing is, what are we doing with what we have right now? So the usual simile is of two women baking a cake. The first woman has the best ingredients, organically grown whole wheat flour, grown in fields where there's no genetically modified crops for 100 miles. They have cholesterol-free sunflower seed oil. They have beautiful honey, and they have the freshest of fruits from Thailand to make their cake. They have the very best ingredients. Woman number two has the worst ingredients. She's got white flour, which is so old you have to pick out the green, moldy bits of flour and to use just the white. And you have cholesterol enhanced butter, you have diabetically enhanced sugar, and really hard fruit, which should have been thrown away years ago. She has the worst ingredients. And my question is, who makes the most delicious cake? It's not just the ingredients. It's what you put into that baking. How much love and care and energy you put into what you have. That's the karma of the present. And it's amazing. I've seen people who have really had a very hard time. Their ingredients were so bad, but they made beautiful lives. They're inspirational. You know, that what they have done with what they've got, just wow. And there's other people who are born into wealthy families, beautiful bodies, fit, rich, don't have to do very much in this life, and they make a mess of their lives. Drugs, alcohol. So it's not what you have from the past. That's already here. We can't change that. So with karma, what are you doing with what you've got? Stop complaining and bake a cake. Recently, I've told this story many times, in Singapore, they had one of these celebrity chefs, Jamie Oliver or something, I'm not sure, I don't watch TV. But anyway, this Jamie Oliver, some of his kind, they invited him onto one of these street hawker markets. And they said, this is what we're baking today or cooking today, you have a go. And so he was competing against the street hawkers. And this was a fellow who was just so well trained and famous. And they asked the random people, what do you think of the cooking? And they said, oh, the street hawkers are far better than this celebrity chef. They had to be. The competition was just so tough on the streets. They put so much more effort and care and love into what they were doing. Their food became more delicious, even though their ingredients were very poor. Streets of Bangkok, same. You go to a five-star restaurant, or you go to the street store. Where do you get the best food? I don't know, because people buy it for me and put it in my bowl. So, but people say, a lot of the time, it's the street stores are just brilliant, because they really have to sell things, and competition is so harder. So that gives them incentive. That's a great simile for Law of Karma. So I don't know what you've got to deal with. Whatever you've got to deal with, fear. Whatever you've got to deal with, just make it the best. The karma of the present. Yeah.
I have a question about caring and curing. I found that very interesting. I think in our jobs, one of the most difficult things is when we see that others perhaps do not care or do not act in a way that shows caring. And that can give maybe some people feelings of hopelessness or losing heart.
Yeah.
So beyond trying to care ourselves, what advice would you have, or what are your thoughts around how to deal with situations where we see perhaps a lot of curing and not so much caring around?
It is actually just to try and give somebody a hug. Isn't it terrible? You can't do that anymore. Me too. If I try and hug somebody, I get in big trouble in Thailand. So you know what? One of the things which I do, it's okay, this is a bit quiche, but okay. Come and join in. Put your hands out, please. Come on, hands out. Like me, just follow me. Bring them in. And give yourself a nice hug. When I give myself a hug, no one can complain that I'm breaking any rule, which a mug's not supposed to hug somebody. And I can't catch any disease which I don't already have. So I'm pretty safe. So I care for myself. That's important. Remember what I said about the wedding? Look at the husband, look at the wife. Never think of yourself, never think of your partner, only think of us. Unit together. Did I say that? Yeah, I think I did. You're in it together. We're in it together on planet Earth. So it's not about me. It's not about you. It's always about us. This is an us world. Like in a family. If there's any problem there, whose problem is it? Our problem. If it's our problem, we can always find solutions. If it's his problem, her problem, the head of the UN's problem, or whatever, somebody else's problem, then we don't find solutions. That's one of the things about protest which is dangerous. Protest means it's us against them. And somehow or other we're not really uniting with the opposition. It's about us. We're in the world together. We can save the environment. We save it for all of you. It's all about us. So to try and get people on board, make your arguments, make them strongly, but don't antagonize and put people further opposed to you. And then, nice protest, good protest. What was that? I'm sure you must know this about the two people arguing over an orange. It's a classic sort of argument and solutions to arguments. Two people arguing over an orange. One says, it's my turn for the orange, you had the last one. And the other said, no, you had the last two, so I have the last one and this one. So they came for a compromise. Cut the orange in half. You have half, I'll have the other half. That's what they did. So one of them peeled their orange, threw the peel in the waste can, and ate the flesh. Half an orange flesh. The other one peeled their orange, threw the flesh in the trash can, and used the peel because they wanted to make a cake. If only they had listened why they wanted the orange, one could have had twice the amount of peel, the other one twice the amount of flesh. That's always the case with when we have contests. We lose so much. Anyway, that's my take on it. So yes, at the back.
Thank you very much. It's been a very enlightening session. I just wanted to talk a little bit about mindfulness, because lately I've been seeing a lot of articles about mindfulness in schools, but I don't see much in organizations or in companies. And I believe from in the UN itself, we do have training on work ethics and how we should work in the workplace, but I believe mindfulness training or some understanding of mindfulness at the workplace, especially how we treat, you know, subordinates, or there's a lot of hierarchy. I believe if this is something that should be part of a training, or if this can be integrated in some work ethics, because I believe, like, we're all here, and then I see in the office a lot of structural hierarchy here, but then once we walk out of this building, of course, we're all just human beings. But I just feel like there's a lot of this space and movement in the organization, and of course in other companies as well, but just wanted a little bit more information if this should be part of a training or a session in the organizations or in the companies. Thank you.
Yeah, it's quite surprising that, yes, this is UN territory in this building over here, but we are surrounded by Thailand. And mindfulness is part of meditation. If you're not doing it here, my goodness, why not? It's so well known. But this was maybe 35 years ago when I was first went to Australia teaching meditation and mindfulness. And there was one of the young women who came to my classes was a school teacher, grade 6. She introduced it to her grade 6s. She called it a different word, calling it quiet time in her class. And after 2 or 3 years, the principal invited me over to give a talk. And simply because he said, I'm a Christian, a very strong Christian, but this works. You can see that the academic achievement of all these kids in grade 6 is amazing. But not just that. The emotional sensitivity to one another. has increased. The class is more friendly and kind. The hierarchies which exist in those classrooms, the boys and the girls, the big guys and little guys, they're disappearing simply because of more awareness. It works. It's cheap. It's just so easy to do. But one of the other things which I've been teaching, said last night, and I'll teach this until I die, mindfulness, relaxation, solving problems. How heavy is my glass of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, I get in pain, 2 minutes in agony, 3 minutes very stupid. What should I do when this glass of water gets too heavy to hold comfortably? Just put it down. Relax. When I relax for maybe 1 minute, I pick up the glass of water again, and actually, honestly, it does feel lighter. Still exactly the same amount of water in here, but because I have rested, relaxed, my arm can hold it without pain and hold it much longer. That is understanding mindfulness, how it deals with stress. The stress in your life has nothing to do with how many duties and responsibilities you have. It has everything to do, when it starts to get heavy, you don't know how to put it down and relax for a few minutes. If you can just relax for, you know, great if it's a meditation room in this place, half an hour. If you can just meditate for half an hour, you go back to your computer, your work. Number one, you have ideas. Number two, because you've rested, your brain is efficient. You can type out something so quickly and it's really good quality. But if you keep pushing and pushing and pushing with no rest, your brain doesn't work well. You cannot sort of invent new ideas. That's one of the reasons why people get stressed. When they get stressed at work, that's one of the reasons why you get this terrible office politics and hierarchies. People's reaction to an unhealthy workplace. Because we don't know how to relax. At work. Don't wait till you go home to relax. The toilets in the UN here, what are they called? Are they called the American way, rest room? I love that description, rest room. Go and have a rest. Sitting there and they say, why are you in there for half an hour? I say, I'm constipated, boss. Oh, that's terrible. You know, nice. Don't tell them you're not just mentally constipated, not sort of emotionally. That's why that it's called in Harvard Business School an investment of time. Bit of mindfulness for 50 minutes, half an hour. And that means in the afternoon you do more work, higher quality. It's in everyone's interest. So, simple solutions. So, whoever is the boss here, please invite them next time. Do some mindfulness training. You should do some mindfulness teaching. Why not? Yeah, there we go. Staff Association. Let's make it happen. Why not? Because what happens is those people who go to those mindfulness training, they become more productive. And they don't react when other people get into the office politics and hierarchies. Because you don't react, you show them there's another way of dealing with life. Not telling people what to do. But asking people, can you please help? A little please, and can you? Instead of, work, you know, I'm your boss, come on. That stuff never works. So anyway, that's a good question. Hopefully I answered it in a short time appropriately. Any other question? Otherwise I have to keep on talking till everybody, the last person leaves. Anyone have a question? Going? Oh, where's... Ah, I've got a hammer. Going. Gone. Okay. Thank you for coming today, and hopefully you enjoyed what we were saying. So do you want to sum up, Manuel, or anything? Do you want to sum up or anything? Say anything? Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Okay, thank you all for coming. I wish you all a happy afternoon. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.